Comments made on the Serotalk Podcast Network are those of the individuals and do not represent Serotalk Corporation, its staff, management, board of directors, or third-party resellers.
Welcome to the Serotalk Podcast.
Welcome to the Serotalk Podcast, your portal to the accessible digital lifestyle.
www.serotalk.com.
A production of Serotalk Corporation, makers of System Access, the System Access Mobile Network, and SA2Go. Learn about new technology, cool software, useful websites, education, information, entertainment, user comments, and much more. And now, here's your host, Michael Loft.
Welcome to Serotalk Weekly, Podcast 76 for September 12, 2011. This is Michael Loft.
I'm Ricky Anger.
I'm Joe Stonkim.
Well, folks, we have a very exciting announcement. We hope you'll be as excited as we are. Beginning here with number 76, the Serotalk Podcast will now be a weekly event.
Yay!
Every week for you, folks.
More of us than you can possibly stand.
Yes, get those 18 news stories sooner than later. And not only will that make our diatribe a little shorter, but then we'll have time to offer more product reviews for you. But there's been a lot of disasters. We've had earthquake in the East Coast, all the flooding, and I don't know, well over 100,000 people evacuated due to flooding from torrential rains. So with all these disasters of late, we thought maybe it was a good time to compile a list of resources for folks. So we're not going to go into specifics other than to tell you kind of some stuff that we have for you. We got links, first of all, for a toolkit if you are more involved in state and local planning and are looking out for disabled persons. We also have essential tech in your to-go bag if you have to take off, 72-hour kit. One thing that we found that I don't know anyone that's reviewed, it's just a link to purchase it, but is a talking first aid kit. So if anyone pursues that and want to kind of give a review of it or something, that would be interesting. We also have the road kit, for those of you who have vehicles, specifics for blind and low vision persons available over at Fred's Head. And this is one you want to talk about a little bit, Ricky, because I didn't know there was emergency numbers built into every cell phone. I just thought you called 911 and went from there. How does
I did too. And apparently there are emergency numbers, at least two of them, one of which is for accessing your battery reserve in your phone, and you can check that one out in the show notes. And the other is a worldwide emergency number, which is 112. So if you happen to be outside your normal country of residence and you're not sure what number you would dial to get emergency services, you can use 112. And they do state that you can do this even if the keypad is locked. And the article says, yeah, go ahead and try it. Although you probably don't want to hit send on that because, you know, the emergency people wouldn't be too happy if you were just like, I just was going to see if you were there, you know, but that is a good number to have. You can also find Red Cross shelters that are open and available in your area with an iOS app that you can search by zip code and see what's available in your area. And it probably should go without saying, but I will just say it quickly. This is something that you should not put off emergency preparedness because you never really know. From one day to the next, everything could be fine in your house, and then you could be under a few feet of water. So you never really know. Take a look at these resources over at the show notes and get yourself prepared.
And speaking of being underwater or just weather-related emergencies, we also have a link to 178 NOAA weather audio feeds so you can hear what's coming before it do. And speaking of radio, there is a radio app that's been a lot of buzz on SamNet. It's called Tap In Radio, and one of the things it has in it, in addition to the radio stations by format and location, are many of the NOAA weather audio feeds. So there's just a few ways to get your weather information. Of course, also we did Tech Chat 46, which was spawned in my mind based on the book 1 Second After, which if you want the dose of reality in a fictional form, that's a book to read. But so Tech Chat 46 was also a good resource. We outlined a lot of stuff there. But moving on into other radio fun, it looks like former New York Governor David Paterson will have his own afternoon radio drive talk show on WOR in New York. And what I thought was interesting in this, Ricky, is Paterson said that because he never learned Braille, he has depended on radio to get his information, leading me to ask the question, if you were Lieutenant Governor and eventually Governor of the state of New York, how important is Braille? I mean, he has a little bit of vision, right? But
yes, but not enough to be able to read large print. I know that he had assistants who would read documents to him, and he obviously managed to do his job with the modifications that worked best for him. But I was a little curious about this too. I wondered what his motivations were. You know, perhaps he wasn't taught Braille when he was younger, but what made him choose not to pursue that in later life?
Speaking as a low vision partial and someone who has been in denial for most of his life, I would have gone much further had I known Braille. There are many, many times where having the ability to read Braille and still make eye contact with those that I was working with would have made things a little easier than when in my younger days, putting a book in front of my face and then trying to talk to somebody. You know, it certainly gives the idea that, you know, there's a little bit of unprofessionalism there on my part. So I had to do a lot of memorization. I had to do twice the amount of work. So from my own personal experience, again, views expressed, mine personally is, I would have done much better for myself in the long run, especially in my government work, if I had known Braille.
Well, some people truly don't need Braille, I guess, with computer technology. I mean, I mainly use Braille for notes, labeling things. However, I do actually script my podcast notes here, so I am actually reading good old-fashioned Braille paper. But most folks would not do it that way. They would either just use a Braille display or Adlib or whatever. But anyway, I just if you have 2 cents, thoughts on that, send us an email at resources@serialtalk.com. Looks like the FCC has reinstated rules mandating networks and TV stations in at least the top 50 markets make 50 hours per quarter or every 3 months of their content audio described. And that must be in place by July 1st of 2012. And the National Association of Broadcasters, NAB, actually supports this decision by the FCC. They feel that they made a fair compromise in not requiring smaller market TV stations to invest the money in upgrading their equipment when they already spent so much on HD or whatever the rationale. But we'll see what comes of this in the future. This is about on par with what the UK has been doing, I think, for quite a number of years.
Exactly. Speaking of audio description, we have a resource that collects some information about audio described theater, films, and video. The thing I found most fascinating in this article was the description of how descriptions are done in a theater. So a play is being performed, and the article talks about how the describer does her work, and she explains that it is scripted beforehand, and she does practice through a couple of performances to make sure that she is not talking over any dialogue. And a lot of people don't know that this sort of service exists, especially for theater production. So it's something certainly to look into when you're going to head out to the theater. This also talks about audio description in movie theaters as well as on DVDs. So check it out.
Yeah, much more taking place in the theaters that I certainly was not aware of. Looks like two stars from CSI Miami are honoring a real-life blind investigator who lost her eyesight 6 months after beginning work in a crime lab. Cecilia Von Berlbingen. I hope I'm
yeah, I wasn't
that
even going
right.
to attempt that one.
Sure.
We apologize, Cecilia.
I apologize, Cecilia. But anyway, she said that basically guide dogs transformed her life. She is 60 years old and the manager of the, let me take a deep breath here, California Department of Justice Criminalistics Institute Forensics Training Facility in Sacramento, California.
Yay.
Yay. So that's pretty cool stuff. Now it's time for
Fun with Phones.
Looks like your phone will soon be able to recognize things that it actually sees. Looks like a mobile browser maker called Layar, I guess that's how you say it, L-A-Y-A-R, added visual research to its web browser. Basically, you point the phone camera at different objects and you should get some cool results. The examples they give, say, point at a historical house and see a video. Or
yeah, actually, they'll be releasing this in the third quarter of this year. They do currently have their augmented reality browser, but it doesn't have visual search just yet. But it is pretty cool. They talk about pointing at a DVD and getting a buy button that you can click to get that DVD right then. So it certainly opens up some interesting possibilities.
Well, I'm interested. It said pointed at a newspaper or magazine and actually be able to share it via social media.
The recent Amazon mobile app just actually activated this in about two days from this recording, that you can actually point your phone, not as a QR code, but you're supposed to be able to point your phone at certain objects and be able to find them on Amazon, or point it to the back of a UPC code. And that just recently came up through Amazon. So
right.
It seems in Japan, you've got QR codes and stuff too.
Yeah, and the QR code thing is pretty interesting. But with this technology, they explicitly say in the article, you know, we're taking a step beyond that because this is visual recognition of an object rather than depending on tagging of that object to do what you want. And I think that perhaps a combination of both is going to work very well. But just speaking as a blind person, it's not always easy to know where that tag may be on something that you want to snap a picture of. So the idea of having, you know, computer-aided image recognition to do this sort of thing is really exciting.
Well, some cool things are, A, it's available for both iPhone and Android, and it can run within apps written, so developers can actually integrate this into their apps. There's a standalone player they can embed. So really cool stuff there. What I'm wondering is if you can point this thing at a TV, and when the Papa John's or Pizza Hut commercial comes on, you can actually go ahead and order the pizza. Be curious to see.
Hey, that'd be cool.
So if anyone out there finds any accessible renditions of this where they can actually play with it and interact with it, it'd be cool to kind of see what it's made of.
Well, Sprint wants to join the big boys now. They have followed suit from AT&T and Verizon and the like, and they've raised their early termination fees for contracts to $350. And ironically, or perhaps not, this comes during the big rumors that Sprint is going to receive the iPhone 5. So the idea is that they want to raise these termination fees so that people aren't coming in and buying a subsidized smartphone like the iPhone and then getting out of the contract with, not too many problems.
We've talked in the past about near-field communications and the ability to use your phone to pay for things or redeem coupons. Verizon, AT&T, and T-Mobile have invested $100 million in ISIS. This is a form of near-field communications, or NFC system, allowing you to use your phone to pay for things and having in-store credit. And it's a competitor to Google Wallet, which should be rolling out at some point this year. But ISIS will also allow consumers to redeem coupons at point of sale. And some things I think are interesting is ISIS also has the partnerships of Visa, MasterCard, and Discover, and American Express, and will be out sometime in 2012. While Google Wallet apparently will be rolling out very shortly. This article says that they already have the support of some, at least, chains like CVS, Petco, and 7-Eleven, but it says now accept Google Wallet, so I don't know where things are there. So one of my questions is, where's Apple in this space?
Yeah, exactly.
And the other big thing, as I mentioned before, this could really increase the theft of phones. What security mechanisms are in place so it's not just an issue of waving your phone? How do you actually make sure it is the phone belongs to said person, not just someone else buying stuff with their phone?
Well, not surprisingly, there has been a lot of talk in the industry about the DOJ's blockage of the AT&T T-Mobile merger. Of course, most people are speaking in favor of that blockage. They do think that it's not a good idea, that it's going to stifle innovation, and consumers aren't going to have as much choice. There's the possibility of higher prices and obviously no healthy competition. But there are a few people who are speaking against this blockage, and not just AT&T and T-Mobile. The few who are speaking out are saying that the merger would have allowed these companies to build out networks in rural areas that don't currently have them, and a few other things. So if you want to check out this group of industry reactions, you can head over to the show notes and take a look.
Yeah, the main thing is that this is certainly far from over. The FCC has not decided yet their position on it. AT&T certainly going to use the courts in an appeal process. Sprint is filing a lawsuit on this matter, and a hearing is set for September 24. So this is certainly not over yet. And should at the end of the day, AT&T not be allowed to acquire T-Mobile. T-Mobile's already making plans to split up its U.S. assets into multiple entities for sale. Skype now works with any home phone via a new cool little device called the FreeTalk Connect Me Home Phone Adapter. Basically, what this does is allow Skype to connect to a regular home phone. You will need to connect it to your computer for the first time to do an initial setup for it. But after that, you just need to make sure that your broadband connection and your phone are actually hooked into this adapter. The adapter allows you to switch back and forth between Skype and a local landline if you still have one. And they do point out that you cannot make emergency 911 calls on Skype. Now, I don't know if that means you can't literally dial 911, but certainly they have no way of knowing your location. And so that might be the one concern, because they're hoping what this will do is make it available to grandma folks that just aren't PC savvy. They can plug this device in, off they go. And of course, there's also a new cordless phone that GE offers that offers these functions, plus the ability to make Skype to Skype calls. And there, of course, have been tools like this out there for a while. There are other handsets. I had a Linksys CIT 2200 or something like that. We played around with that. And I had another one I could switch between the landline and Skype. So these certainly aren't new. But, you know, if you've played around with these, let us know. We'd like to know your experiences at resources@serotalk.com. Have you played with any of that good stuff?
No, I haven't. And to me, this sort of comes from the why would you want this department?
Think about it. Well, I could tell you exactly why you'd want it. I mean, you could take this, wire it into your home phone system.
Yeah.
Maybe for one thing, you know, maybe you have more people in your home than computers. So you could wire this into the phone system. Who this is really going to hurt are ISPs that do phone service. And they come in and wire it into the phone system for $20-$40 a month. Now you can integrate this right into Skype.
But Skype is perhaps a bit less reliable than a lot of other VoIP phone providers. I don't have a landline anymore. I do use a VoIP phone system called VoicePulse. And the advantage of this is that you can do emergency 911 calls. When you first sign up, you set this up, giving them your address, and they're able to pinpoint your location and associate this with your account and so on. And you've got a pretty good uptime. You can do E911. And I don't see what advantage Skype brings to the party.
Well, it's just another way to do this more economically, although you're right, it's certainly not as reliable as it used to be when it reached its peak, although some of that actually has to do with internet service providers. And there are certain ISPs, because I have two, actually, and it's the geek that I am, one does a much better job, you know, maintaining Skype calls. So it'd be interesting to see where that goes. The other stuff, though, on the phone land, Speech-to-Speech is a free 24-hour service for people with speech disabilities. You can try it out if you need that service at 800-854-7784. And in some places, you can dial 711 and just ask for Speech-to-Speech. When we come back, we'll give you all that Apple news many of you have been waiting for, as well as your chance to see with your tongue and all that cool stuff, all coming up on the Serotalk Podcast 76.
My name is Tom Thornton.
And my name is Cindy Thornton. We've been married 38 years, we're retired, and this is how we live united.
We play golf and we travel, but we also decided we were going to give to and volunteer with United Way at our community free health clinic.
I do the nursing at the clinic.
I work the front office, checking in patients, greeting them, making them feel comfortable.
United Way is how we contribute, because we know our time and money are going to the right places, the places that need it most and implement it best.
Judging by the thank yous we get at the clinic, I'd say we're doing the right thing with our retirement, too.
We even get a few bless yous. It's incredible.
We're Tom and Cindy Thornton. We volunteer at our community free health clinic. So we don't just wear the shirt.
We live it.
Give. Advocate. Volunteer. Live United. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
And welcome to Podcast 76. Again, now a weekly event. We hope you'll tell your friends. Maybe it'll make it more habit-forming to know it's here for you every single week. But in Apple land, it looks like an article talks about how Apple technologies will help people with disabilities use Apple devices more efficiently. It talks about that Apple's applied for a patent to allow people to actually bypass the touch screen and use Braille and other displays, joysticks, and various wireless devices. And from what we've read before and talked about, some of these Braille interfaces could be different from what we think about as the conventional 12 to 80 cell Braille display. It says this protocol could also be allowed to use voice commands, and that some of that may be built in the underlying infrastructure of iOS 5.
If you've been curious about Apple AirPlay, we've got a video tutorial that talks about how to set this up with your Apple TV so that you can bring up something, perhaps a YouTube video or something from Netflix, although why you would want to on your iOS device when you could do that on Apple TV, I'm not sure. But in any case, you can bring up whatever media you like from your iOS device and have that transmitted to your Apple TV so that you can see it all in nice high definition and hear it in surround sound and whatever you like.
And now time for Google News. We just heard about a cool audiobook player for Android, Read Books, spelled B-O-O-X. This audiobook player for Android will work, I guess, with the built-in voices of Android, but sounds best if you use some Ivona voices. So it works with Ivona, and this is spawned by a developer initiative, spawned by Ivona. So you can play around with that, and this is a great opportunity to talk about the upcoming, soon-to-be-released, first edition of That Android Show, yay, where you can find out all the cool stuff that's going on in Android land with JJ Meadow and Access Anna.
Yeah, That Android Show is going to be a monthly show, which will feature JJ and Anna and myself doing reviews, interviews, and all sorts of things about what's going on in the Google Android ecosystem. And this month, we're going to have an actual developer who did something for iOS, but now is doing something for Android, and he's going to talk about his experiences. And we have some reviews of Flip Zoo, which we talked about last week, and I do a little bit on iBlink Radio and some others. And if you have ideas or suggestions or things that you would like us to cover, just shoot it over at resources@serotalk.com. And follow us on Twitter at ThatAndroidShow, all one word.
Very cool. I'm looking forward to listening to this show, although I don't have an Android device. Back to books for just a moment. The Google Books app for iOS devices, which was previously inaccessible, is now usable. Also, the Read2Go app for iOS devices made by Bookshare has just received an update with some bug fixes and some enhancements. So, bibliophiles, go ye forth and read stuff.
So, Ricky, you being the Amazon How to Use Kindle Queen, are you excited about this new Kindle that's going to run on Android?
Well, I'm a little concerned, actually, because for those of you who don't know, by the way, Amazon is planning to perhaps abandon its current implementation of the Kindle in favor of something that is running Android. Now, it's going to be running Android 2.2, I believe, so they're not even touching Honeycomb on this device. They're going to begin with a 7-inch screen device and perhaps later expand to a larger tablet. The problem with this, I think, is that it's a very restricted version of Android. So just because the device itself is running Android doesn't mean that you're going to have the functionality of being able to go to the Android marketplace to install additional apps and things like that. So there may be no way to make this accessible. It may be very locked down. Then again, it may not, and I may just be pessimistic. But currently, Amazon plans to have Kindle. They also have a way to watch entertainment, movies, that kind of thing on the device from the streaming Amazon offerings. And they got a few other things. But again, I'm concerned at how locked down this device seems to be.
Well, you have several things at play here. You have Amazon, who has the ecosystem to take on Apple with media, movies, books, what have you. But you're right. You do have the danger of forking an operating system. There are already three or four major forks of Android in China. And we're starting to see that, of course, with the modding community, where you have 5, 6, maybe 7 different Android markets out there. Even the Android market for Amazon, you have to do what's called side loading in order to get that to work. So again, it's one of those where you can't say that Android is Android in the same way that you can say that iOS is iOS. You know, for Apple, the operating system, be it that there's a variant on number, is still kind of iOS. Android, it gets kind of freaky because you have different shells, different mods, and different versions. So fragmentation is something that Android has always had to deal with. But if anybody can pull things together, it's certainly Amazon.
I guess my hope was that this would be the tool they could use to make it more accessible.
If they choose to do that, now then the question becomes, are they going to use TalkBack, which certainly has some limitations, their spiel, or are they going to try and develop something themselves? By the way, this device is a completely touchscreen device, so there are no buttons on the device itself. So whatever they use, they're going to have to be sure that if they do implement some form of accessibility, that it obviously needs to support touch screens. You're not going to have a D-pad or something like that.
Well, the rumors are that it's going to come in at $249, possibly, be that as it is. That's pretty affordable for one of those early adopters out there on Twitterverse or on Facebook to let us know what they think, or to see if there's built-in accessibility, or perhaps even this very podcast might actually do something like that when the unit arrives, because as in the past, we've demonstrated to you guys that we'll go play with things like the Amazon Kindle, as you can see from our review last year, the Kindle 3 or 2. Was it 2 or 3? I can't remember now.
It was 3.
They come out so fast.
Well, this also really sets up a portal not only for audiobooks, but, you know, if they wanted to work a partnership with radio reading services where they could actually make a device that actually streams the newspapers and magazines directly to people. But again, I don't know if the touchscreen is going to be the easiest interface to that. I guess you could do anything online now. One thing I never would have thought about is a virtual online pet. But Google apparently has angered quite a few folks with disabilities when they killed a service called SuperPoke. This allowed people with disabilities to create an online virtual pet, maybe because they could not have one of their own in real life. But another story that Ricky is, I know you've been very staunch advocate for, it's Google rolling out offline support for Gmail, Docs, and Calendar. And first in place is Gmail. So my question to you, have you played with it and what are your thoughts?
I haven't played with it yet. Now, this support is specifically for Chrome. So you're not going to see this as a Firefox extension or anything like that at the moment. But what you're able to do is read and respond to your mail while you're offline, and then whenever you get an internet connection again with your device, it's going to send those things. As far as docs, you're able to read those docs, but you can't yet edit them. They do say that that support is coming. The same is true for calendar. You can look at your calendar, but you cannot create a new appointment when you're offline and have that update when you get a new internet connection. But I'm glad to see that they are offering this sort of support, because as much as I am enamored with cloud computing, there are times when, let's say, I'm on a plane and it may take me 4 hours to get where I'm going. I want to be able to do some work during that time and have that stuff update whenever I connect to the internet once again. So this is good to see. By the way, Google has made some accessibility modifications to Google Calendar. If you want to go check out the agenda view and let them know what you think about the accessibility of that, you can do so and send your feedback to accessibility@google.com.
Get a job, Sean-a-na-na, Sean-a-na-na-na. But how do blind people get jobs? Well, the live event has already taken place, and I hope there'll be archives available of this, but the San Francisco Lighthouse broadcast live September 6th through the 9th. Over 60 people sharing their different success strategies and finding and keeping their jobs, many different vocations, and many very distinguished, established people. So again, hopefully these archives will be made available, and if so, we'll link to those at SerilTalk.com and of course on Samnet and even iBlink as well.
The NFB has made available some free employment seminars for download. These were actually recorded at the National Convention this summer and have now been available for download. If you weren't able to attend the convention, or you did, and perhaps you'd just like a refresher course, these seminars cover a really wide variety of subjects, and it's not focused on a single type of employment. So, for example, if you're just thinking that this is going to talk about customer service and call center employment, it doesn't at all. It also goes into how to search for a job. How do you do successful networking, that sort of thing. So you can check that out.
NIB President Kevin Lynch outlines that employers really don't have to spend near as much as they think they do to hire quality blind and low vision employees. Of course, you can read more about this at SerilTalk.com, but the gist of it is that looks like 92% of people favor companies who hire persons with disabilities, and 87% of people say they would actually prefer to do business with companies that give employment to folks with disabilities. 56% of employers said that accommodations cost them absolutely nothing, which means a state or some other entity picked that up. And JAN, the Job Accommodation Network, said that cost is usually less than $500. So I have to ask Joe about that one. I agree that a lot of employers probably are scared and don't hire people because of feared costs, but these numbers sound a little too good to be true for me.
Absolutely. I have always questioned these kinds of things. I've tried to say them in employment situations with major employers. It's true if it's a low vision employee, because then you're just doing some things in large print, getting a larger monitor, which you may already have on site. Unfortunately, when you get into the areas of doing Braille displays, unless the person already has a Braille display or is working with an agency to help provide a Braille display, those numbers get kind of skewed. And so it's very easy to look at it from a low vision perspective. And, the trick is, as someone who used to work with employers, the trick was to get them to understand that, you know, it's not going to take a lot of money to implement that if the technology is already there or available, or as the agency we provided it. So it's, again, one of those where you have to kind of understand where the technology is coming from, and eventually somebody pays for it. The good news is that when you have that technology available, then yeah, there isn't that much you need to do, because you already have computers. The software is fairly affordable. And when you have the technology behind you, you can do just about every job out there that has to do with professionalism and IT and call centers, and some of the places that most agencies are targeting is what's called multiple placement sites.
Well, there you go, folks. You got it from the master, guy who's been there and done that, seen that. A few other links to government stuff we'll quickly mention here. You can check them out at SerilTalk.com. Your path to government benefits is at benefits.gov. If you want some more information on education for folks with disabilities, it's disability.gov/education. We also link to a PDF on making Medicare Advantage and Medicare drug coverage work for you. So check all that out at SerilTalk.com. The Guardian details the 2012 Paralympic Games to be held in London. There are 20 sports, and 17 of those actually come from the 26 sports that are conducted in the standard Olympics. And there are 6 different disability categories. So you can read more about it. It goes into great detail about it. And there was 5 for physical disabilities and 1 for intellectual, but they actually banned the intellectual disabilities for the last 2 Paralympics because 10 Spanish basketball players actually had no mental deficit. So I don't know how they test for all that, but it goes in and talks about all that at the article. So you can read more about that at SerilTalk.com.
The NFB Jernigan Institute is hosting the 2nd annual Web Accessibility Training Day. That's going to take place on Monday, September 19th. And basically, this is a day dedicated to talking about web accessibility. How do you create accessible content that's going to comply with federal and state regulations? And whole lots of great presenters there, including Adobe, Oracle, eBay, and actually some folks from the World Wide Web Consortium.
Yeah, you can register for that at nfb.org/web accessibility or give them a call at the main NFB number at 410-659-9314, extension 2410, if you want to participate in that September 19th event. Well, speaking of NFB and the folks over there that review products, the NFB did a review of Cerotech's DocuScan Plus. Now, Ricky, I want to hear your thoughts on this. A couple observations I had. First, I'm not sure why they whine about the fact that DocuScan Plus for Windows takes up 150 megabytes on your hard drive when things like K1000, OpenBook, and even OmniPage 17 gobble up 600 meg. I'm also wondering why, at least in their findings, they say it runs faster on the Mac than it does on Windows, unless maybe they're talking PDF documents. I think PDFs might have an advantage on the Mac, but as far as scanning, I'm not sure. You know, there's no outline of what hardware they're using to test the equipment. It just, to me, seemed kind of thrown together, like, oh, we have to do this. I don't know, but what was your take on this review?
Well, I don't know. I found it interesting, like you, that it scanned faster on the Mac than on the PC, especially given that on the PC, the 150 megabytes that they talk about is at least partially comprised of the local OCR engine. We don't have that for the Mac, and so all of the recognition is done right in the cloud. So perhaps it has to do with the speed of the computer versus the speed of the network connection. And they may have just found that their network connection was great. It was able to send the image up to the cloud, get it processed, and send it right back, whereas their PC, which would be using the local OCR engine, was a bit slower at doing that. In this review, they're using the HoverCam T5V with DocuScan Plus, and they do mention that lighting is a concern with this document camera, as it is with any document camera that you're using. So you always want to make sure that either your room is well lit or that you've turned on the light on the document camera that you're using. If you haven't checked out DocuScan Plus before now, now's a great time to do that. You can head on over to DocuScanPlus.com and begin your 7-day free trial for either Windows or Mac.
We recently posted this month in Access Technology with Wade Wingler, Jeff Bishop, and Kelly Ford, and some very interesting dialogue about the news stories for the month of August. And as you may know, we were looking for new names for the Tech Chat, and what we've done is we've narrowed it down to about three. So we need your input in deciding which of the three names shall replace the infamous Tech Chat. Our choices are Digital Dimensions, Minds That Mesh, or Cerospective. And we give you three ways to kind of communicate with us and let us know which of those three you prefer. You can email resources at cerotalk.com. You can post your comments on Twitter, as many have done, with the hashtag of @CeroTalk. Or you can use iReport, which is on the homepage of iBlink Radio for both iOS and Android. We give thanks to Ann Bliss, Daryl Bowes, and Rick Alfaro, who each gave us a suggestion, one of those three, and for that receives $50 Cerotech, and the winner will actually receive an additional $100, giving them $150 Cerotech bonus that they can use for products and services. But we hope that you will vote and put in your 2 cents and help us name the show that allows the voices of the blind community to be heard.
Hey, check this out. What? The robots are coming.
Oh, it's the android uprising.
What?
Great.
No, I mean a robot uprising.
No. Look, those are androids, see?
No, but there's a difference.
Oh, yeah, there's a difference, because androids
are... Let me stop you right there. Because if I'm going to hear anything about android, it's going to be from JJ, Anna, and Joe on that android show.
What android show?
That android show.
Oh.
Listen to that android show for reviews, interviews, and more concerning Google's Android on the Cerotalk Podcast Network.
Well, if you are looking for a handheld color identifier, perhaps you want to check out the Color Test 2, which is a talking color identifier. It can help you do things like match your clothing. Look at one thing that they suggest is that you can figure out if food is ripe or not. And I'd never thought about doing that, but yeah, I suppose you could. Now, the advantage of something like this is that it's not giving you just 8 or 16 colors. There are quite a number of shades, so you're going to be able to get a really good idea of what matches and what doesn't?
Well, this is actually a physical handheld device that, in addition to the 1,000 variants of color, also has a clock, timer, calculator, thermometer, and three games, rechargeable battery, available in Spanish and English. And I got kind of hyped up, saying, yeah, I might add this little device that's about the size of a TV remote. Then I looked at the price, which is $745.
And this is why I like my $1.99 color ID apps for my iOS device. Although with that said, that device does not have a thermometer, but it does have a clock and a few other things. In any case, if this is something you're looking for, if you just want to have a separate device that does this, or perhaps you don't have an iOS device or a device that has an app which can actually do this for you, you might want to check this out.
Good evening, good afternoon, it's evening.
When computers converse with each other, crazy stuff can happen.
Out of the mouths of bots.
Yeah, chatbots. While they don't always get their point across or communicate in the way you would hope, sometimes they have greater intelligence and greater conversation than you might see on reality TV shows. But you can check out this article and check out what happens when chatbots, computers, talk to each other and try to make sense and use logic and reasoning.
Yeah, I wish that they had mentioned which two bots were conversing with each other so that you could go and take a look at each of those bots. The video, at least as far as I know, doesn't mention which two bots are conversing, but it's actually rather fascinating. So you want to go check out this article and see what kind of mayhem is caused when two bots converse.
Well, this is a slightly different one. We talked before about a $25 computer. This is another one called the Raspberry Pi. $25 computer running OpenGLS 2.0 with 1080p video and USB 2.0 with your choice of either 128 or 256 mega RAM. I think if you spring for the big 256, you have to pay $35. But I guess the big question is, can this little credit card size computer, can the OpenGLS actually be made to talk? Is this something that we can actually derive some benefit from?
Well, it can play Quake 3, interestingly enough. So, perhaps it can be made to talk. These are shipping with Ubuntu and Fedora and Debian, I believe. So what you would need to do is use a USB hub to hook up all of your devices, including a sound card, because this one doesn't come with one. But it's a very interesting project to take a look at.
Lori Burnson throws out the first pitch an L.A. Dodgers baseball game, and you can read more about that at serotalk.com. So if that's ever been a goal of yours and you thought that never as a blind person you could throw out any pitch on a ball field, apparently the sky's the limit.
That's right. Well, Google has patented a glove for seeing with your hand, and this is a bit different than the glove that we spoke about on the last podcast, where you're actually getting feedback through your fingers about what is in your environment. I believe this particular device is a way that you can move your hand into places that you normally wouldn't be able to see easily, and that information is transmitted to a camera so that you can actually look around in your environment with your eyes by using your hand. So could be some interesting things going on with that.
Well, we talked about this before and got blasted, but remember the BrainPort, the device? You hook the electrodes to your tongue and it communicates with the visual cortex of your brain. But Lighthouse International is conducting a study and looking for people interested in playing around with the BrainPort. So if you want to hook it up to your tongue and see if you get some visual impulses, you can certainly contact them and get the link over at serotalk.com.
Well, they do talk about tongue fatigue, and this is one thing that I had been genuinely curious about. If you were using this device and you have these vibrations on your tongue, if you've used your tongue to see for a while, would it eventually become numb or just unable to perceive certain things? And that apparently is a concern that has come up during the study. But interestingly, those who are testing it have been able to do things like read large print. Now we're talking about letters that are 4 inches high, but they have been able to do that. And again, if you're interested in taking this for a spin yourself and participating in the research, go check out the link for contact info.
Some side effects may include
9-volt battery syndrome.
That's right. Millions of people suffer from NVBS.
Well, just think of the fatigue you have on your finger. Those of us who played around with Opticons can imagine having vibrations on your tongue.
And your tongue, at least to me, is so much more sensitive than a finger. It seems like that would just be absolutely distracting, to say the least.
What if it nulled your sense of taste and you had to choose? Do I want to see 4-inch high letters or have the ability to taste that great cuisine?
Oh, wow. That'd be weird. Yeah, you finish reading this novel in 4-inch high letters, and then would you not be able to taste at all, or would things taste just different?
Everything tastes like metal.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking.
Nulled chicken.
Old tuna fish.
Oh, yes. Well, our final story in news land here looks like bionic eyes come to market in Europe. At least partial restoration of vision for some people with retinal degeneration diseases. It's called the Argus 2, and it can be had in Switzerland, France, and the United Kingdom. And they are seeking FDA approval. Hopefully, this device will be available in the United States at some point in 2012. Coming up, Patrick Perdue reviews the Fostex AR4i. It's a cool little audio mixer with some high-quality microphone input, so you can put your nice, beautiful, resonant quality microphones into your iPhone for some better in-the-field or in-house recording. So stay tuned for that coming up on Serotalk Podcast 76.
Thanks for joining us. And remember, the Serotalk Podcast is now weekly, so we'll see you again very soon.
Hey, hey, hey. I know you got that Fostex. All right.
Hey! This is Patrick Perdue, and today I'm going to talk a little bit about a new audio interface for the iPhone 4 that's made by Fostex. And it's called the Fostex AR-4i. The song you just heard actually came from the demo of another Fostex product, the MR8 multitrack recorder. But I thought it was kind of appropriate, so I put it in here. I hope nobody minds too much. But in any case, this particular product from Fostex, the AR-4i, is something I've been looking forward to for as long as I've had my iPhone, maybe even a bit longer. Before I got an iPhone, I heard about the Blue Mikey, which is something that was made for the 3GS and the 3G and maybe some of the older iPods. And I thought, oh, cool, something that records in stereo and maybe does a few other interesting things as well. You know, with the iPhone, there's a lot of interesting possibilities. But unfortunately, the Blue Mikey did not work with the iPhone 4 when it came out because of internal changes that Apple made to the dock configuration. And Blue's been saying for over a year, yeah, we're going to make a new Blue Mikey and it's going to be compatible with the iPhone 4 and the iPod 4th Gen and all that. But so far, they haven't actually done it. And neither has anybody else, as far as I know. So here comes Fostex. They've been around for quite a number of years, and they made the AR-4i recording interface for the iPhone 4. And it does specifically say on the website iPhone 4. It doesn't say anything at all about the iPod Touch 4th generation. I'm not sure if it works, and because of the way the case is designed, I'm not sure if it would even fit. It's really obvious when you look at it that it's very optimized for the kind of squared edges that the iPhone 4 has. So my concern is when the iPhone 5 comes out, if it has this radical case design that everybody's talking about, is this going to work anymore? But we'll see about that, I guess. And speaking of the case design, let's actually take a look at this unit. If you're holding it so that the phone, if you had the phone in it, would be in portrait orientation, if you look on the bottom left, the first thing you'll see is the headphone jack. And this is one of the things I like about it. It actually has a real volume control. What's actually real looking, it's actually a digital volume control, but it looks analog and it feels analog. But anyway, on the bottom left, we have the headphone jack for the Fostex, followed by, just above it, a mini USB port. Above the mini USB port, we have input 3 or 2, and I'm not really sure which, and it doesn't really matter, and we'll talk about that later. Above that, we have one of the two tripod screw threads, and there are two of them, one on the side and one on the bottom. And above that, we have the headphone volume control. On the right side of the unit, on the bottom, we have 4 LEDs just opposite another thumb wheel, which is the microphone input gain. These 4 LEDs apparently double as a status indicator, and they'll also tell you, if you can see them, of course, if you need to back down on your input gain. Above the thumb wheel for the mic input, we have input 1, And then above that, we have some kind of clip thing. I'm not really sure what this is for. I've seen these kinds of things on cameras, so you can mount lights and stuff. I'm not sure if you're supposed to do that with this, or if this is just so you can run cables a little nicer if you're running external mics on a tripod. Not really sure about that. But then above that, we have input 2 or 3, and again, it really doesn't matter that much which one of the two it is. The entire front of this unit is just about what you'd expect it to be. It's just the empty slot with the dock port on it that you slide your phone into. And on the bottom front, it says Fosdex. I'm assuming that's what it says. It's in raised letters, but I can't quite read it. And then the back of the unit kind of bugs out a little bit, more than I wish it would, actually, where you insert batteries. It takes 2 AAA batteries, comes with 2 alkalines, and let me tell you, I ran those down really fast. On the Fosdex website, it says that this thing is rated for between 8 and 10 hours of battery life on 2 AAAs. Well, I've been playing around with this thing for a few days, and really it seems to be about 4 or 5 hours. Maybe I just need a better set of batteries, but it really doesn't seem to be any better than about 4.5, maybe 5 hours on a good day. And I forgot to mention, it's about 3 inches long by 2 inches deep by about 2 inches wide. It weighs about 0.5 pound, and it's built out of both plastic and aluminum. The outside is plastic, and the back of the inside where you put the phone is aluminum. It looks pretty nice and sturdy. Included in the box, we have 2 microphones that include windscreens, and these are cardioid mics, directional mics, that you mount on the side of this unit, an aluminum hand grip that you either screw on to the side or the bottom where the tripod thread goes, so you can just hold this thing by this large aluminum hand grip, and a cloth carrying bag with a drawstring. Sure, why not? So let's stop talking about what this thing actually looks like and hear what it actually sounds like. So what I'm going to do is record a short bit of audio from the internal iPhone microphone, followed by some audio from the Fosdex with a few different microphones, just to give you an idea of why you might actually want this thing. So everything you hear from here on out until the very end will be recorded with the iPhone. And this is the very stereotypical sound you get when recording from the internal mic on the iPhone 4. Before I got the Fosdex, I tried all sorts of stuff to, you know, just try to improve the audio a little bit. But no matter what microphones you use, what cables you buy, and what adapters, whatever, it always basically sounds like this. You always have that low-end roll-off, auto-gain, and all that sort of stuff, so this is definitely not a high-fidelity option. And this has always been one of my biggest complaints about the iPhone. The microphone itself is probably great, but something in the electronics just filters it a little bit. And I've actually heard recordings that people have made with the 4th-generation iPod, which sound a lot better, and even the old iPhone 3G, not the 3GS, but the 3G, that also sounded quite a bit better than anything you can get with the iPhone without modifying it or using another external source. So now I'm going to switch to a mono microphone on the Fosdex AR4i, using the iPhone 4, the same recording application, same settings, just so you can hear the difference. And this is a mono microphone on the Fosdex AR4i. Not a particularly awesome microphone, but it's one that I've had sitting here for years, and I figured it would work pretty well for this purpose, just to demonstrate that this, in fact, sounds nothing at all like the iPhone. And this is because the Fosdex AR4i is actually a USB audio interface. The dock on the iPhone actually includes USB audio in and out, unlike earlier versions of the iPhone and the iPod, which use analog connections on the dock port. Until now, nothing has actually really been able to take advantage of the fact that the iPhone has USB audio, and this is because the phone doesn't provide enough power. In fact, it doesn't provide any power at all to any device you might plug into it. I guess they did this on purpose because of the small battery. But in any case, the Fosdex gets around this by being run from 2 AAA batteries. So you're actually not using any additional power from the phone, at least no more than you would be normally, when you use this thing, because it's self-powered, or as self-powered as it's going to be when it's running from batteries. And because this is a USB audio device, it bypasses all of the internal circuitry on the phone for input and output of audio. And this is why it doesn't have that filter, and this is why it doesn't sound anything at all like the iPhone itself, even though it still is. And now I'm actually going to start recording in stereo, using the included microphones that come with this unit, which I'm going to go ahead and say aren't really all that awesome. They really could have made these better, but they get the job done, and they're still better than the internal iPhone microphone. And now we're using the 2 included microphones that come with this unit, in stereo, with the phone pointed in landscape. And I'll tell you why this is actually significant. This unit, rather than coming with a built-in microphone or set of microphones, is interesting in that it comes with 2 mono microphones that are angled at a 90-degree angle. You simply plug these microphones into the side of the unit, which has three inputs, by the way. All of these are stereo inputs. It's a little bit weird, though, because it's set up in such a way that you can use this in either landscape or portrait orientation. It actually has two tripod threads, so you can mount it to a tripod either on its side or on its end. And the way this is set up is you have input one, which is actually, if you're holding the phone so that it's in portrait orientation, is on the bottom right of the unit. And input two is above it. Input three, which is really just a copy of input two, is directly opposite on the other side of the unit from input two. And if you have something plugged into input 2, input 3 will not work. As I said, they're basically just a copy. It's just another jack that does exactly the same thing. In the app that comes with the AR4i, it's actually labeled as input 2/3. And the reason they set it up this way is so that if you're using it in portrait orientation, you can just have one mic on the left and one mic on the right. Or if you're using it in landscape, you can do the same thing. Only the mics would basically be on what looks like the top instead of facing forward or backward. However you want to move the mics around, you have the flexibility to do it. So let me just walk around a little bit so you hear kind of what this thing does. I'm recording late at night, so we'll just step outside the back porch. And one thing I will say about these microphones is you have to be very, very careful about how you use them. Because they're not very forgiving about shielding. They do come with windscreens, but they're not very effective. And electronically, I don't think they're all that well shielded either. But regardless, it's a stereo image, and it's still better than what you get from the built-in iPhone mic, as I said before. And there's really not anything interesting going on right now. That's a shame. Of course, the good thing about this unit is that you can use your own microphones. The way this is set up right now is input 1 is actually panned to the right. Now, I would normally think that something called input 1 should be on the left, just because I'm used to, you know, left, you know, one left, two right, that kind of thing. But this is actually set up so that input 1 is usually, almost always, going to be the right channel when you're using these microphones that it comes with. You can reverse the image. You can put input 1 on the left and input 2 on the right, and that makes sense maybe if you have the microphones pointing backwards. And because they're simply plug-in mics with, you know, a 90-degree angle, you can flip the microphones in any direction you like. But in any case, you can use your own stereo microphones. This thing is set up so that all you have to do is go into the app and change the microphone panning position from either left or right. Just letting the car pass there, from either left or right to center. And when it's set to center, it's actually a real stereo input. So you can plug in a single eighth inch stereo microphone or a set of binaurals or a single point or whatever you want to use to one of those jacks, and it actually comes out in stereo. And I'll be doing this in a minute with a couple of different microphones so you can see how they react with this particular unit. I have a few stereo microphones that I definitely prefer over the ones that come with this unit, so we'll see how they work. But before we do that, of course, we have to go back inside. As we've now done. So now I'm going to switch to one of my favorite stereo microphones, the Audio-Technica AT822, which is a single-point stereo condenser. It's been discontinued for a while, but I still love it. There are, of course, better microphones out there, but they're also a lot more expensive, and I don't have them. So here is the AT822 on the Fosdex AR4i. And this is the Audio-Technica AT822, plugged into input 1. Inputs 2 and 3 have been disabled, and input 1 has been panned to the center, so that we have a real stereo image on one jack. So the Fosdex AR4i has a couple of processing options that might be of interest to some. It has a low-cut filter, 3-position, at either 200Hz, 500Hz, or 1 kHz. And this is so that you can remove maybe unnecessary bass in your recording. Sometimes you might be in an environment where you have lots of road noise, or maybe you're in a car, and you don't want all that bass, you know, makes things easier to clip out. And you can certainly do that. It also has a limiter, which you can set to either off, slow, or fast. Of course, one of the big reasons I wanted to try this unit, apart from the fact that it has a stereo input, and that it's the only thing I know of for the iPhone at this time, for the iPhone 4 anyway, that allows you to actually record with a real unfiltered input, is that, well, it's unfiltered. One of my biggest complaints about the iPhone, as long as I've had it, has always been the sound when you record with it. Because with the built-in microphone, you always have this filter at around 200 hertz. And everything below 200 hertz is kind of rolled off and doesn't really sound that good. It's fine if you're recording voice memos or whatever, and it might not matter so much. But if you're using the video camera, for example, well, it's got good video, so you might as well have good audio with it as well. This recorder certainly adds the better audio option. Another thing I took into consideration when I bought this unit is that I don't necessarily want to use it as a dedicated recorder. I have plenty of other stuff I can use for that, and honestly, yeah, the iPhone's kind of cool, but there are certain things I just don't want to do with it full-time, and recording's one of them. I mean, just imagine if you're recording something important and a phone call comes in, ring, ring, oop, there goes your recording, because it has to redirect the audio to the phone, and, well, no more recording for you. I mostly bought this thing to try using it with stuff like the video camera and a program I use for streaming audio called Papaya Broadcaster and even chat programs, just to make those sound a little better. I've been playing with something called TeamSpeak lately, which is a very high-quality chat, 48 kilohertz mono. Sounds really good on the iPhone, and now it can sound even better. Electronically speaking, though, this certainly isn't the quietest unit around. It is a bit noisier than I thought it would be, but at the same time, it's also the only option right now, that I know of anyway, as of the time of this recording, for putting a real signal into the iPhone 4. And I'm sure, as time goes on, other people will look at this and they'll go, ooh, let's do this better. So this is, as far as I know, the first of its kind, and it's very new. I think it only shipped or started shipping a couple of weeks ago, as of early September 2011, and so we'll just have to see how that turns out. So I'm going to go back in the house, and I'm going to try this recorder with another set of microphones, a set of binaural mics, and see how they handle this particular interface. These are a set of modified Panasonic capsules that Will Taylor and Zoe Tulip did. These used to be called Wizoliums, but they're no longer being made, but they're still pretty good. So let's see what they do. And this is the sound of these particular microphones on this Fosdex AR4i recorder. My self-perspective is going to be a little bit strange because of how these mics work and where they're pointed, but that's pretty typical for this kind of thing. Oh. Let's be interrupted by the time one alarm going off. Or we'll just leave the room. So let's talk a little bit about apps. The Fosdex does come with an app, but it's not a recorder. It's just a controller for the unit. And this sets up the various functions like the limiter and the bass roll-off and panning the individual inputs, turning them on and off, that sort of thing. And it's perfectly accessible. There's absolutely nothing that doesn't work. There is only one thing you need to really know that might not be obvious. When you're in the advanced mode, it has two modes, advanced and preset. And when you're in advanced mode, which lets you set up all the custom input things, and you go to pan one of the inputs, there are two buttons that say pan. It goes in the order center, pan, reverse, and off. So all you really need to know is that the first pan button is pan left, and the second pan button is pan right. But other than that, it's perfectly fine. But it doesn't come with a recorder. So I tried a few different recorders that all record in stereo, and a couple of applications that are not recorders that either stream audio or just take audio in general and do something with them. The app I'm actually using to record this at the moment is a free app that was actually made for another external microphone on the iPhone 3GS and 3G called the Blue Mikey, and this is Blue Fire Field Recorder,
There are two additional things called Firefield Recorder. One is Fire and one is Fire 2, and it's made by Audiophile Engineering, and they're both $5.99 each. I did actually buy Fire 2, but unfortunately, unless I'm doing something wrong, I can't seem to get it to record. It has a slide to record button or a switch or something, and no matter what I do, I just can't get it to work. I've spent about 20 minutes just sliding it or trying to slide it around up and down, left and right, horizontal, whatever. I could never get it to work, which is rather unfortunate. This particular version just has a regular button you press to record, and it's a record, kind of record, pause, stop toggle you can append to your recordings. With Blue Fire or Fire 2, you can either upload to an FTP site or use a web browser to pick up the files from your phone. But with Fire and Fire 2, you can also do fun things like sync to SoundCloud and upload to Dropbox and all that sort of thing, which would be really nice, but unfortunately, I can't seem to get Fire 2 to work for anything other than looking kind of nice. Oops. That's not good. I just found a silica gel pack that was a bit split. And now there are silica gel thingies all in the sink. Well, that sucks. I tried another one called Concert Recorder, which looks pretty old, actually. It mentions iOS 3, and it doesn't look like it's been updated in a while, but I tried it anyway. It was $4.99, and it records at 44.1K 16-bit stereo PCM wave. There are a couple of interesting issues with that recorder, though. Some of the buttons are not exactly unlabeled, but they're a little weird. You can certainly tell what they're supposed to do. But the interesting thing with this particular recorder is as soon as you launch it, it starts playing stuff out of the iPhone internal speaker. When you have the iPhone sitting inside the Fosdex AR4i, it defaults to the headphone jack on the interface, which is nice because you can also monitor what you're recording in real time, as well as hearing your speech from the iPhone. Unfortunately, though, as soon as you launch Concert Recorder, everything starts coming out of the iPhone internal speaker, which is not necessarily a good thing. So it does work, but it's a little inconvenient. There's also List Recorder, which also records in stereo. I haven't played with it extensively, but it certainly does work. And there are probably quite a few others, but I haven't looked at very many options. I played with Papaya Broadcaster, which is an app that lets you stream to Icecast or Shoutcast servers. That works in stereo. FlipZoo also works. However, if you use this in conjunction with the AR4i, it really doesn't sound so good. I think it's like 11,025 hertz, 24 or 32 kbps MP3. It really sounds pretty nasty. Papaya Broadcaster, if you have the resources, is definitely a better option for sound because it uses a much higher sampling rate, and you can set the quality and stream in either stereo or mono. With FlipZoo, well, it never sounded that good to begin with, but in stereo it's even worse, so I definitely wouldn't recommend that. And if you really want to, you can even record in stereo with the built-in memo recorder on the iPhone. For some reason, it does record in stereo when it detects that there is a stereo input. The video camera records in stereo, of course, as you might expect. And I'm sure several other things do as well. You can even use this with programs like Skype, if you want to improve the sound of your microphone a little bit with that. Or TeamSpeak, which I've been playing around with a little bit lately, or even Heytel. Why not? It works. Impress all your friends by having slightly better sound than everyone else on Heytel. Well, that's kind of a dumb reason to buy this thing, but if you really want to, it certainly will do that. And I'm outside again. Not really sure why. It's a pretty overcast. I was sort of hoping I might get caught out in the rain while recording this, but apparently that's not going to happen. Nah, well, we'll just go back inside again. I think overall this was probably worth the money, just to have something that interfaces with the iPhone and gives it a real audio input. It may not be the best sounding real audio input in the world, but as far as I know, at the moment, this is pretty much the only way to get a real audio input into the iPhone 4. And as I said earlier, I wouldn't necessarily use this as a dedicated recorder. There are cheaper and better options. I'm specifically thinking of the Zoom H1 here. You really can't get better than that for $99, or one of the Olympus recorders. Cheaper, better stuff will probably exist in the future. This is really the first of its kind that I know of anyway, and I've been looking for this kind of thing for as long as I've had my iPhone. So maybe you might want to wait for that. Maybe stuff will be better in a few months. Maybe when the iPhone 5 comes out, the landscape will change again for the better, hopefully. But if you're like me and you want to play with stuff now, then here is the Fosdex AR4i. For about $150, you can turn your iPhone into a slightly nicer recording interface.
And there you have it, folks. Recordings from the AR4i recording interface and the Bluefire Field Recording app. By the way, this thing retails for $199, street price of $149. This is what I paid for it at zsounds.com. I'm sure Amazon sells it. Full Compass didn't have them in stock and wasn't going to have them in stock for a few weeks. This is usually where I prefer to get audio stuff. So I bought it from zsounds, and that seems to be pretty much the going price for this thing, about $149 US. So if you're in the market for fun accessories for your iPhone 4, definitely give this a look. Reporting for the Saratalk Podcast Network, this is Patrick Perdue. You've been listening to Saratalk. Visit us at www.saratalk.com. Send us an email at resources@saratalk.com. Send us an iReport with iBlink Radio, available in the Apple App Store and the Android Market. Or leave a voicemail at 866-997-BLAB. That's 2522. We may read your email or play your voicemail in the next podcast. Join us next week as we explore all that life and the internet have to offer. Until then, may you have an accessible digital life. We'll